You're listening to the John C. Scott Political Forum. This podcast is a Bustos Media production on The Voice. Be sure to subscribe wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Thank you and good afternoon. Welcome to part two of our July 12th edition of the John C. Scott Political Forum. I want to thank Jimmy Zuma for being with us from Washington, D.C. Dustin Williams, the Pima County School Superintendent, spent some time with us. And then Crystal Foster, a member of the TUSD School Board, talked about the future of TUSD. Keith Rosenblum is with us now. He's covered Mexico and Mexico politics for 30 years or more, is a regular on our show, and we're so pleased to have his expertise and observations. Here's Keith Rosenblum. Hi, Keith.
Good afternoon, John.
Well, you know, I went to the Benedictine Monastery for a two-hour broadcast and then spent some time before and after the broadcast with the migrants that had been moved from, obviously, the border of the United States after they'd trekked across all of Mexico from one of three cities, or three countries, which would be El Salvador, Honduras, and Guatemala, and then wound up in Tucson as they continue on to another location where they have family members or other friends waiting for them. You get to meet these people. You get to see them in their eyes, see their children play, hear them talk, hear them laugh, and talk about 400 volunteers who make them feel at home. And you're talking about a whole different image than much of this country has about these migrants that are invading our country. Wouldn't you agree?
They are human beings, John Scott.
Well, that's what I want you to talk about. You know these. You've followed this story for years now, and you know about these immigrants, and you know the relationship of Mexico to the immigrants, the United States to the immigrants, the border, and all the problems. Tell me what you know about these people that I don't know.
Very little, because my experience is, and this goes back to reporting, and it goes to the time I was privileged to work with Congressman Colby. It goes to this. It goes to we want solutions on the macro, but when it comes to the micro, it's Congressman or Keith or whomever. I know this guy, and I just believe he really needs a shot. Once people become human, once you realize just how much we have in common, a lot of the doctrine kind of dissipates. And if you extrapolate from this, you wind up with how we tend to dehumanize people. And so whether it's Sudan or whether it's Germany in the Nazi era or whether it's Bosnia, Croatia, as long as you can keep people a little bit less than human, gay America or gay people, period, and then by religion, people who are disabled, people forget that in the case of Germany, that it wasn't merely Jews who went to the camps. It was Jehovah's Witnesses. It was gay people. It was the disabled. The idea of having the pure, the Aryan race as the superior one. So it doesn't surprise me. Your experience doesn't surprise me. And I think that if the raids take place this weekend, as we've been told they will take place, we've actually been almost given a game plan. It's fascinating for me to watch the we have to do it because we're law enforcement, because these are the laws, versus the human nature of this and how it will play out when it becomes real in people's living room. And whether we like it or not, images are powerful and images sway people. And the guy in front of the tanks in Tiananmen Square, the shooting of the Vietnamese guy, I forget the circumstances in Vietnam, that became an iconic picture, the little girl running from the napalm. There are so many pictures, the most recent ones of the dad and the daughter in the dad and daughter, I can't remember, hey, Rio Grande. All these things all of a sudden make people human. And even if we do want to enforce laws and we consider it a mandate to do so, we can't be less than human. We still feel, and we think, is this really what we want to be doing with our law enforcement? Do we want to be a little more flexible? Do we want to uphold the letter of the law? Do we want to allow some room for the spirit of the law? And these are things that would weigh on anybody when they do as you did and go actually meet the players. And I'm going to take this conversation to the other side. Border Patrol, CBP, the agencies that are doing their work, a lot of these guys are caught up in the same thing. These are family people who also become human when they hear the stories too. Border Patrol and CBP get these raps of, you know, there are these guys trash talking and making things up at the website. There's always going to be, with any organization, there's going to be a percentage of people to do that. It's just a truism. And they're told not to take it home. Paramedics are told that. Cops are told that. Don't take it home with you. This is your job. We convert people into robots. We convert them into this is what you have to be done. And I know I go, you probably get tired of the metaphor, but it really is Roadrunner and Coyote and the chase for the chase's sake. Have we forgotten what the original chase was about?
You know, just a particular point, too, where you have a president of the United States calling these migrants animals, suggesting they are less than human. We've always had people that have demonized those that would cross this border that do not look like us or maybe even talk like us, that are different. And we've always seen political gains from people from the far right.
Hey, we're good at that. Don't worry. We were good at that with Black America.
Oh, well, we are. That's right. You're absolutely right.
We can make black people into three-fifths of a person.
Yeah. You can
in the legal system. We got lots of homegrown, or we'll call them indigenous cases.
We do, and you know, you get to a situation where seeing what you see every day and what I see every day, or at least talk about every single day, an entire, I think, political picture that is slanted one way or another for the benefit of those who slant it. You know, I mean, it's just.
I would urge your listeners to one day just go. I've had the eye-opening experience, not only of covering lots of trials. I expect that I'll go to watch the Scott Warren trial again and see what exactly it was that the federal prosecutors wanted to do in order to nail somebody who was for his own personal convictions, was leaving water for immigrants. But also just go to immigration court, when the 300 West Congress, just go spend an hour or two. It's open to anybody, and to watch these cases. And if you're not weeping as you listen to one by one, then you aren't human.
You know, and especially at the particular location of the monastery, you have literally people in transit. They're going to only be there for two or three days, then they're going to be moved to someplace else where they have family members or friends or people that are going to support them along the way. But they are there with children and all the responsibilities that go with that, and they are there with an experience unlike anything else you and I have ever thought about, like walking across Mexico. I mean, who's going to do that? I mean, what is it, 1,000 miles, for God's sake?
You know what? Yeah, these are people that are going to be, these people are going to be hustling. With a society where 1 in 7 of us is on food stamps, and a lot more get welfare checks, and a lot more are on some kind of disability, these are the kinds of people who don't have an excuse book. Or at least this generation and the next one, they're not going to learn it.
You know, you take a look at the whole policy of the United States government at the border. It seems to me to be almost schizophrenic. I'm not sure anybody understands the rules anymore. Do you?
Yes, I do, but they're. I'm not sure if we're doing the Byzantines, the Byzantine Empire, a favor. The rules are Byzantine, and I'll tell you a case in point. This is fascinating because this just shows you how weird it can get. I have a brother-in-law who's undocumented and he's been working undocumented for many years, and he's now cost the taxpayers about $130,000 because he's been in one of the private prisons. This is one in Adelanto, California. He's also in Florence. And his great crime after being undocumented was that he got picked up by TPD on a misdemeanor DUI. Then he was released. My family, we posted the bond for him. And after he was let go of the private facility the first time from Florence, comes, does his time, pays $200,000 for the penalties for his misdemeanor DUI, told he can't drive again, but now he's going to be able to come out. He has a sponsor to install artificial turf. That's what he does, that artificial grass. And right as he's about to go back to work, he gets out of Pima County Jail, and he's met by ICE. By Immigration and Customs Enforcement. And they say, guess what? You thought you were actually free to go, but no, you're not. And so after he's done his 5 days in jail, and after we've posted bond for him, ICE meets him and they take him off now for the next 5 months to Adelanto. Total puzzle. We held on to him for 5 months and now he's back released again and now he's able to go back to work. But we, I don't know whether you follow whether it was, I'm not sure whether you, how you follow the dollars, but it cost you and me. And I understand he's here undocumented. I can't, I'm not going to make an alibi for him. I'm saying he made a decision to come here undocumented and he's here. But anyway, where I was going to, and you asked me if I understood the explanation of the immigration laws, he can stay in the country now if he can make a case, get this, if he can make a case that his, it would be an extreme hardship on his mother, the mother's like 85 or 86, that he would, otherwise he would be presumptively deported in December. So he's got to make a case that it would pose extreme hardship, not to have grandchildren who are American citizens or daughter or children who are residents, but for his mother. So anyway, he's got to work on that, on making that case. It's so interesting. I mean, these, where we came up with these policies, and you can see how the Congress is writing these rules, and they bring in somebody and say, well, what do you, how do you think we should phrase this or that? And they wind up with some pretty weird stuff. But that's our chore between now and December, is for him to be able to make the case that his 85-year-old mother would be, whatever that legal terminology is, it would represent extreme hardship if he were to be deported. Isn't that strange?
It is bizarre. Not just strange, it's absolutely weird. By the way, Keith, I don't think we're going to get any immigration reform before 2020. We're all moving toward this presidential election. The Congress isn't going to do anything about this. And without it, we're going to go through this whole process year after endless year with a schizophrenic policy that nobody understands and punishes everybody. I mean, seriously. It is almost a hopeless situation. It really is. They're going to keep coming, and we're going to have to deal with them, but you don't have a government that has the ability to write any rules or regulations that make any sense anymore. They just don't make any damn sense. Taking children away from their mothers? Putting kids in jail in a cage? Are you kidding me? Good God. I mean, it's just amazing to me. Well, that's
it's,
just my...
No. It's weird, but also if you... if you have laws, you enforce laws. I understand. I can argue both sides of this until we're both blue in the face.
Well, that's true. I'm sure you can, but it's just not going to change. The numbers are down. I guess it's the, what do you attribute that to? The heat, the weather, the summer, what?
You know, there are these mysteries that we don't find out about until later. I don't really believe it's the heat. I do believe the message is getting back that we're being tougher. But tougher messages don't keep people who are threatened from coming anyway. That the U.S. courts are a little tougher, that people have to stay in Mexico now, or the third, what's it called, the third party, third country safe, third safe country, whatever the terminology we're using is. You can speculate on it. We'll learn what it is afterwards, and we'll learn what it is from the actual interviews of detainees and of people back in the host country. That's why we have embassies and consulates, and so we can figure out what's happening on the ground in places like El Salvador, Honduras, or Guatemala. I don't know the answer to that. It'd be interesting to know. Probably the people that you talked to at the monastery might have been able to tip you off.
Well, Keith, that's great talking with you. I learn from you every time we have a conversation. I wish you the very best of the holiday weekend, and I'll talk to you next week. I promise.
My pleasure.
Always great to talk with you. Thanks so much for your great work. Keith Rosenblum covers Mexico, has for decades, and is just really damn good at it. He's one of the best journalists in the country and a regular to the John C. Scott Show. We're going to talk with Leah Marquez-Peterson, who is now a member of the Arizona Corporation Commission. From the frying pan into the fire. Is it that way, Leah? We'll talk with Leah Marquez-Peterson in a moment. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the John C. Scott Political Forum, now in our 31st year of continuous political talk. Howard Fisher, writing in the Arizona Daily Star, talked about the lone Democrat on the Arizona Corporation Commission, accusing the newest member of using her office to advance her election chances. In a filing at the commission, Sandra Kennedy said that Leah Marquez-Peterson appears more interested in pleasing Governor Doug Ducey, who appointed her to the job, and Don Brandt, the chief executive of the parent company Arizona Public Service, than in getting answers from APS about what led to the heat-related deaths of a customer last year. Here is Leah Marquez-Peterson. Well, you asked for this job, and here you are. So you
well,
can't stand the heat.
On, John.
You know, what the heck?
No, I appreciated it. I mean, as you can imagine, in any statewide role, this is so political. It's a shame that it's turned to that so quickly. I mean, I've enjoyed the position. I've been in it about 6 weeks and I'm learning a ton about utility regulation and electricity, water, wastewater, pipelines, railroads, securities, business incorporation. I mean, I don't think enough of our community understands just the broad array of issues in front of the Arizona Corporation Commission. Unfortunately, though, it is an elected position and it's turned a little bit nasty, a little bit political. And it's a shame. You know, I really would had hoped to forge relationships with each of the commissioners and to build on that and to really seek solutions. In the Phoenix area, we're dealing with, you know, some very important issues related to the death of Ms. Pullman, heat-related death and APS and holding them accountable as needed and also working through with the ACC staff in terms of what procedures and policies there are in place so we can ensure this doesn't happen again and we can protect our citizens and focus on public safety.
What is your answer to this? If I call up and say, look, I can't pay my utility bill, and they will say to you, too bad, we're going to turn off your electricity anyway. And I would say to them, look, my wife's had health issues and whatever, and I've changed jobs and whatever. I don't have the money. And they would say to you, tough, we're going to turn off your electricity anyway. Let me tell you, our air conditioning went out last year for about a week until we could replace it. It is insufferable. It is deadly. It is the most horrible thing I've ever experienced in my life. Now, I got a couple of portable air conditioners to kind of offset the enormous heat problem. But, you know, if you don't have the resources to do that, it is deadly. We're talking about life and death here. So should not there be a policy that you could at least ask for a deferment until someone could investigate as to whether you can pay this bill or whether you can't, rather than be dead because you couldn't pay it?
Well, and you're absolutely right, John. So the ACC, our commission, moved immediately for an emergency procedure to not allow disconnects for the next 4 month period during this very high heat season until October. So we reacted immediately, but we need to go beyond that. I've written letters into the docket, which is how this works. You write letters to communicate with your fellow commissioners and to the utilities, asking for utilities throughout the state, water, electricity, and so on, whether they're regulated or unregulated, to send in their disconnect policy so that we can have a thorough understanding of what's happening throughout the state. As we tackle this in our meeting in August that's been so politicized and in the media related to APS, there are situations like this happening throughout the state. It's not just a Maricopa County issue, as we know. We here in Pima County may be facing this, or Apache County or other places throughout the state. We need to be able to tackle this and understand as a commission exactly what the proper procedures are. Just today, actually, I was up in Phoenix, drove back down to Tucson, and I met with a group called Wildfire that provides resources and the communications for those who are low income throughout the state. They've got some great resources I don't think people are aware of, and I want to know what we do as a commission and what we can do to help publicize and communicate that to folks throughout the state who are in need. So I think there are a lot of things that we can do to tackle this challenge.
Well, I'm going to tell you, these people are terribly insensitive, the ones that I talked with. And they had information about it. I said, look, I've had service here for 40 years. Are you kidding? I mean, you can't give me another 10 days or something? No, we can't. Well, we're going to send it up to, I guess, a supervisor for a review. Well, that took about 10 minutes of me sitting in my car waiting for whether I could get 10 more days on it. And then they said, well, tough. Nope. You got to pay it. We're going to turn it off tomorrow. Whatever. And, of course, you jump through all kinds of hoops to be able to do that. But, I mean, were I someone who did not have the resources, nor the ability of friends or anybody else that would help me through a difficult time, I would have been in real trouble. Real trouble. They would have shut off my electricity, and I would have been with 115-degree heat in terrible trouble. And you know, and there were people with much less resources than I had to be able to deal with this $215 bill, or whatever the hell it was. And after I've paid them hundreds of thousands of dollars over the years for utility service, they would treat me like that. There just has to be a policy that takes into consideration difficulties people have, and they do have them over periods of time.
Yeah.
And you ought to be able to excuse that.
No, you're right. And so folks listening right now who might be in this situation should realize because of our emergency ruling at the Arizona Corporation Commission, their utilities cannot be shut off during this very hot time. This is life or death if you weren't to have air conditioning or water. So they should absolutely call their utility if that's the case they're in. They also should be aware here in Pima County that we have a community access program that does provide assistance and relief, and you need to be eligible for the program. So they should call Pima County if they are facing this. But we need to do a better job at communicating this to folks throughout the state. And the thing is, every disconnect policy is different with every utility. So what can we do as the Arizona Corporation Commission to streamline that?
Let me take you to another issue, and that is Tim Steller's column talking about you as building up the Hispanic Chamber into a juggernaut, really a chamber of the year for the Hispanic chambers all across America. You increased it by adding other communities of membership that literally took the membership to an amazing number. Then he said, well, you left it in a bad financial shape is basically what he is suggesting in his Tim Steller column. What was your response to that column? I haven't seen anything that you've written, but no, I'll let you just talk about it. What let's talk
I
about that.
I appreciate you bringing that up, John. So I was very disappointed in Tim Steller. I was not appreciative that he attacked the Hispanic Chamber, which I no longer am at, in this fashion. What I explained to him when I did this interview is that when I left the chamber, we did not have financial hardship and we were not in any kind of lawsuit. Like any nonprofit organization in this country, much less here in Tucson, when you've had a leader at the helm for almost 10 years like I was, and you've had change, you've had new leadership come in and she's no longer there and other leadership's now come in since her, there have been ups and downs. And I think every nonprofit organization can... Executive director, perhaps, who's listening can relate to that. So I want to do all I can to ensure that the Hispanic Chamber continues to be strong and to has the support of the community. But, you know, like any organization, changed some programs, changed some events, had different membership and how they retained them and grew them. And so they've got to find their way. So I thought it was unfortunate that Tim wrote that article as kind of a political attack on me. And drag the chamber into it. I thought it was a shame.
Yeah, that's exactly what it was. I mean, I'm not going to try to excuse that in any way, shape, or form. Are you saying, wait a minute, there were no unpaid bills, like a particular, I think it was a bill for an event held at the Eastside Hotel and a couple of other bills that had not been paid to Pima Air and Space Museum. But those bills were not delinquent when you left, right?
When I left, no. Those bills were not in place. Certainly, like any organization, we had invoices in place and we were making payments. So certainly, like any organization, we had bills due, but we were not in the financial hardship that he was referencing in that article. And I know since that article, the chamber has worked very hard to recover, and they're doing quite well, and they're growing again. They've got a great chamber administrator in place named Isabel Georgellos. They're having a lot of mixers and events and workshops, and so I just think it's a shame, and it was a shame to take an organization that had grown so dramatically and had such positive impact on our community and try to beat on it like that through the Arizona Daily Star.
When you expanded to Nogales, Sierra Vista, and Douglas, you got an additional 1,000 members, wasn't it? At least that much?
We were at 1,000 members here in Pima County when we grew into Douglas, Sierra Vista, and Nogales. And since then, launched the strategic partnership with the Arizona Chamber of Commerce, continued to grow till we were 1,800 members, doing a lot of cross-border trade mission trips, as you know, doing a lot with advocacy. So I'm very proud of the work that we did, and the board of directors did with the Tucson Hispanic Chamber while I was there. I left in about November of 18. They had another leader in place for a little while. She's no longer there, and now they have Isabel in place as a chamber administrator. And I think they're in great shape. They're moving forward and doing some really good things.
Yeah, did you attempt to respond to Steller, and he ignored you, or what happened?
I did not. I don't think it's probably worth trying to take on and fight with the paper, as you can imagine. I had a lot of people express how unhappy they were with seeing an article like that by Tim Steller on social media, and certainly called me and certainly called the chamber and the board. But no, I mean, some of those fights aren't worth tackling. I think he's going to continue to cover, as will other reporters, all the different work that we're doing in the Arizona Corporation Commission, and he should focus there. If media is not happy with a particular vote I take, then hold me accountable for that. But don't go back to former organizations or boards I've sat on or whatever and start beating on folks just to take a political attack on me. I think that's ridiculous. I think now what I'd like to talk about are, you know, AHO and rate increases they're seeing there. Or
what's the deal? You can't let them increase the utility rates as high as they're going to increase them. We're talking about APS, I believe. In AHO, you can talk about turning off the electricity. You're going to turn off the whole damn town. lights. Yeah. I mean, you can't allow this. Why the hell? Why are they going to get away with this?
Yeah, and actually, Navajo, it's not APS. It's AIC, the Ajo Utility Organization.
Where does that power come from?
It's owned by Freeport-McMoRan.
It's owned by the mining company, right?
Right. In May, prior to me being appointed, Commissioner Andy Tobin was in the seat. The commission voted down the recommendation for the rate increase. In just this past couple of days, the AIC, their Ajo company, came back to the commission with a recommendation from the staff for an increase. Where you might have read the article in the paper is I was very concerned about the rate shock to people in Ajo. It's a low-income community. There were a number of people that wrote letters. Pima County supervisors wrote letters about the dramatic impact this would have on residents, on seniors, on small businesses throughout the Ajo region. So I'm one vote of five. I need to get two others to support my position. But I went in there to reduce rates at that commission meeting and unfortunately was not successful. So my fellow commissioners voted in the increase that you saw listed in the paper, and it's going to be a hardship for the community of Ajo.
Does anybody want to go over there and walk a few streets? I mean, I've walked the streets of Ajo. I was involved in the Barbara LaWall campaign. I was the campaign manager for Barbara LaWall, the county attorney, a couple of years ago in 2016, and went to Ajo on a couple of occasions, walking door to door and talking with people. This is a low-income town. This is a town that was abandoned by the mining company after the mines closed, but it's had an incredible arts renovation. It's had, I think, an incredible amount of community support for each other, because most of these folks are just struggling. And then you hit them with a huge rate increase like this, you're killing these people. I mean, you know, they're just folks trying to make it. There's no wealthy people in Ajo unless they're a mining executive that just wandered in and wandered out and wandered back. I mean, that's it. There's just I don't think there's a millionaire in the town unless they're that
I don't know about that either. But you got to think, what's the role of the Arizona Corporation Commission? Because of course, so many folks don't know. But we're to provide safe, reliable, affordable utilities. I'm 6 weeks old now on the ACC, and certainly I've been able to impact rates positively, a reduction in rates in Apache County, which I was very proud of. It was during my very first meeting. Wasn't successful in Ajo, convincing my fellow commissioners to change the rates. But I'm going to continue to fight for the ratepayers, for the citizens. This is vitally important that, again, it's safe, reliable, and affordable. And there's so many issues that we're working through on the ACC. That's why these political battles that unfold just are so upsetting and unfortunate. You know, I really want to focus on providing solutions. I'm the only one on the Corporation Commission who's not served in an elected role. A lot of the other commissioners have been state legislators or mayors and so on. I'm coming from the outside with a different perspective, and I hope a fresh perspective to the Arizona Corporation Commission that people appreciate. So I've opened office hours in Tucson as a commissioner, so I'm able to meet with folks from southern Arizona who perhaps can't take the drive up to the Phoenix area to meet with me in that office, and really going to start trying to get around the entire state so I can meet with folks and talk about water, electricity, wastewater, and all the other issues that we tackle.
Yeah, once you took on a statewide race like yours, you're going to find out how big this state is. Well, you've already found that out, haven't you? It's a big state.
Oh, absolutely. It's been very interesting to talk to folks with different issues in different communities. We don't regulate city and county-owned utilities, but all the private entities. And there are more than 300 water companies in our state, lots of electrical utility companies that we're talking to. I'm learning a lot. I have really enjoyed it. I find it very challenging, but I've got a great staff, great team, and great staff at the Arizona Corporation Commission to help me through these various issues.
We want to remind people that you were appointed to this position as Tobin left, the former Speaker of the House, by the way, and you have to run again in 2020. So you're involved in a campaign from the day you were appointed, actually, really.
Yeah, and I've not yet filed, but I will do in the next couple of weeks. But I will be running statewide to retain the seat in November of 2020. And I'm the only Southern Arizona person we have in a statewide elected seat and the first Latina to hold a statewide seat in Arizona. So very proud to be here, very appreciative of the governor to select me to be appointed to the Arizona Corporation Commission. And I'm going to work hard to do a great job.
I hope you'll be on our show often and communicate with the people of Arizona through our mechanism and talk about what you want and what you want to do.
Absolutely. No, okay. I would love to.
All right. Leah Marquez-Peterson, thanks for being with us. We've known you a long time.
Thank you, John.
And we appreciate you being on the show. Thank you.
Thank you. Have a great week.
Bye-bye. You bet. Leo Marquez-Peterson on the John C. Scott Political Forum. You know, this broadcast is sponsored by Perfection Auto Works at 1046 North Beverly and Mike Emery. I've got to know this guy. He's just an amazing individual. And so proud to have Perfection Auto Works as a sponsor of our show. I'll be back with Steve Rivera. We're going to remember George Khalil, the powerful and amazing figure that was all a part of Arizona basketball for as long as anybody can remember here. He is gone. He is dead at the age of 81, but it leaves a legacy far beyond anybody else's reach of the University of Arizona Wildcat basketball. Remembering George Khalil with Steve Rivera next. Steve Rivera, host of On Eye on the Ball, which is the best local talk show in sports in all of America. And he's one of my favorite sports, commentators. Steve Rivera, thanks for being on the show. Appreciate it.
Good to be here, John. I'm glad to be here with you right before my show.
First time you met George Khalil, you remember? First time.
Had to be like 1990. I was here in Tucson. Got here in 87. Obviously, he's a staple. You see, who's this guy? He's always around, and was always around basketball and Lute and that program with Bobby. But I started covering the team full time in 1990-91. So it had to be about that time. I think it was 1990. Arizona was playing in the tournament in Long Beach State, and he had tickets. You know, he was the guy with the tickets. And I know that I needed to do a front page story for the paper at the Citizen. And he says, "Well, who's the fan guys? Who can I do something?" Only one guy.
One guy.
George Khalil.
That's right.
And he was the guy. I remember talking to him then. God, it's a long time ago.
And he started following them in the very beginning of the Lute Olson era?
Well, no, 72.
Oh, my God.
72. I did a story yesterday, part of it.
With Snowden, right?
With Snowden. Apparently the paper, this is what he told me, apparently the paper did a reach out to people. If you really want to join this team, go on the road with them. So he did. They went to Fort Collins, Colorado, and then to Laramie. You're well aware of those trips, WAG trips. So he went on that one to Colorado. They lost that game. So he decided there was not a whole lot of things going on, not a whole action. So he got one of those big bass drums. I'm sure you've seen it a time or two back in the day.
Yeah.
So he got one of those, took it with him to Laramie, and they won the game.
Wow.
So he became this big guy with this big drum, beating the heck out of the drum and kind of rallying the troops.
I'll be darned. That's an amazing story.
And then it was for 7 years he was able to do that.
So he went to almost every single away game, almost, no matter where.
If
Laramie,
not,
Provo, you name it.
If not everyone, because that's, in fact, he carried that drum for 7 years after that, and until the BYU chancellor did an ordinance.
No
more drums. No fans could bring their own instruments into the arena.
No kidding. Wow.
So about 10 years, I wrote my recent book 4 years ago, but part of it was some of the claim to fame for me, at least, was there are very few people that miss games. In the time that I was there for 23 years, Brian Jeffrey was the number one guy. He rarely missed a game, if any.
Sure.
Next was George Khalil.
He was a play-by-play guy, right?
Because he had to. That was his job.
Sure.
George Khalil was second. I think the only game that he really missed was when Snowden passed away. He went to the funeral.
Wow.
I remember that day because we were in Los Angeles. He left and he went, came back to watch the funeral. And then it was me because I missed the birth of my son.
Over how long?
Over 23, 20,
you
20
years.
You
missed only one?
Two.
Two games.
Two games.
In 23 years?
In the time I covered, so 18 years, 18, 19
Good
years.
Good grief.
My son was being born in 95, so I missed the Washington trip. And then Lute had missed a couple because he had a bad back. And then when Bobby was passing, he missed a couple of weeks. So in that time, it was Brian Jeffries, George Khalil, me,
you
and
were in the
Lute.
Top four.
Top four, right.
Did the program just accept George?
I mean,
it was a kind of a mutual admiration.
Well, he had to work his way into it because, remember, he was
with Stone. He wrote out some checks, too. Big ones, $1 million at one time.
That helps.
Yeah, that helps.
If you're buying dinners for people, guess what? They show up for dinner.
Yeah, they do. I understand that. Yeah, they do. It's amazing.
By the way, when are you buying me dinner?
Yeah, not tonight.
So he was with Stone for all that time. Lute showed up, and I guess he must have endured the Ben Lindsay years because yesterday Cedric said to me that he remembered walking with Khalil at Stanford and saying, Cedric, you have a problem here.
Yeah.
And it was Ben Lindsay, obviously. Yeah. So, you know, Cedric went and got his guy, and his name was Lute Olson. So I guess in that interim, when Lute got the job, it took about 2 or 3 months for, you know, him to feel out what was going on in the world and the local scene and who was involved and who wasn't. And George was one of those guys because he's always been involved. And I guess George was invited to a party, and Bobby was there, and they became fast friends. And if you're fast friends with Bobby, you're in.
You're in.
You're in.
Yeah.
Lute knew better. Don't mess with Bobby.
Yeah. You know, and Channel 11 played a critical role in that way back in the Snowden years, because obviously they find a way to tape these games and then play them again so that people could experience University of Arizona basketball every game they played one way or another. Now, it might have been by delay, but they could experience it. And then, of course, Jim Click sponsored it. Became a huge sponsor of the University of Arizona basketball and football programs. And through Channel 11, they had a local connection they never had before.
Mm-hmm.
And Gene Adelstein, who was the general manager
at the
time.
That was like 75-ish?
Yeah, that was in the mid-70s. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I did that play-by-play 73, 74 when I was in the state Senate and just went to, you know, did every game that we could do. That was football, not basketball. And Gene Adelstein took over doing basketball. And, of course, he and his team did it for years.
I would imagine how funny it was, because sometimes how did the tapes go from Laramie to Tucson without delay?
Well, it was the team. Whenever the team got back, they had the tape.
They
took it to the TV station and played it.
I bet you a time or two they didn't want to take that tape.
No, they didn't want to take it. They just said, no, we're not going to take this one. But that's basically the way it happened.
Yeah, that makes sense.
The first game we did was at Fort Collins. I'll never forget. That stadium was fairly new. It was Colorado State Rams, and just amazing.
Right,
you know?
Right. Well, I grew up watching the WAC. I was in Santa Fe watching it from Albuquerque with the Lobos and that group. And it was, what a fun time, because it was crazy.
Yeah.
It was scoring 100 points a game, no defense.
Well, and the rivalry between New Mexico and Arizona and Snowden was just amazing.
Huge, yeah.
And Snowden was, you know, not only a great character, but he's a great coach. And, he never got the credit, I don't think, for some really amazing things that he did.
Bob Elliott said he was called me out of the blue yesterday, in fact, but he's often said that Lute would not have come here had Snowden not been here.
Really?
Because it showed that basketball was good here in Tucson.
Yeah.
And because of Snowden, he ignited that.
Yeah, and, you know, Herm the Germ and, you know, Colonial Norman. And
In fact, Rappus
and all these guys.
I've been trying my darndest to get Colonial Norman on the show.
I mean, is he still around?
He's still around. I almost every day. I pester him. I haven't got the word back.
That guy could hit shots like no one else. I saw him in Provo hit 40 points, and he shot him from in the stands.
Well, Herman Harris.
It was the most amazing I've ever seen in the WAC play.
Him, Herman Harris, I guess there was no three-point line at the time, obviously. I don't guess. No. I know that they would have destroyed the three-point line.
Oh, my. It was just, Cornel Norman, he could hit from anywhere.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It was just amazing.
I think he's a trivia question. I don't want to say this because I could get it wrong, where he played with one team in the NBA one night, got traded, and then that team had to play that team again.
Oh, really?
And he was part of two box scores at the same.
Really?
It was very bizarre.
I'll bet that is weird. Absolutely. How long was he in the pros?
Not too long. Yeah. Not too long. Maybe 3-4 years, maybe.
Yeah, that was about it.
Yeah, back in the day, even now, in those days in the NBA, if you got a cup of coffee, that's good for you.
Well, and of course, Arizona then made a rivalry out of UCLA, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, they would go to the regionals, and that was just the biggest deal on the face of this earth.
Sure.
It was just astounding. And then, of course, when Lute came, it changed everything.
No question.
But it didn't happen overnight.
No.
I mean, and that first year had to be brutal for Lute Olson.
How many
games did he lose? It was a lot.
Well, I think they won 8 games this first year.
Yeah.
But he says this all the time, or said this to me back in the day, when he first got here, after every practice, he'd put his hands in his head and say, what the heck were you thinking?
I'm a Final Four team in Iowa City. Yep.
And they had just built them a new stadium up in Iowa.
Exactly.
Well, look how it turned out.
Yeah, it turned out great for Arizona. There's no question about that. Let me ask you about Khalil through that whole process. He was a fan. Through the bad times, good, and the Lindsay years, there were terrible times.
Huge fan. You know, he was a fan, very good, didn't get high, didn't get low, was just there for the support. In fact, there was a story in the book where Arizona played horribly, lost big, and he had to get on the bus, and he asked somebody, I think one of the coaches, is this always this way when they lose?
Yeah.
Until they win again.
Yeah.
Until they win again.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
You know, and of course, George, which is a really amazing guy. If you sit and talk with him, you know, he's a friendly guy,
very
open
much.
Guy, and
yes,
you know, I mean, he was an enormously successful financially.
Sure.
I mean, he was a multimillionaire many, many times over. But he was a philanthropist, too.
Sure.
He gave away, I don't think people will ever get a final count of how much money he gave away.
No question.
It was hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars. In fact, million, he gave a million to the U of A.
Yeah, 2014, he gave a million there. Just a few months ago, he gave a million to Sal Point to do their gym, redo
That's
their
right.
gym.
And people would come to him and ask for help, and he never made a big deal out of it. He just wrote out a check.
Yeah, he would. He was a guy, a nondescript guy. It's funny because I'd see him on the road because I went to all the games, obviously, L.A., San Francisco, things like that, where he would go with the team if Bobby wasn't there, and obviously she wasn't after she passed. But a lot of the managers, after they did their stuff, would go to the movie with them, or he'd go to the team dinners or whatever, or he'd be in the lobby with peanuts or on the phone working. He was always working, or seemingly always working.
Oh yeah, and his business just grew, and because he really he never left it.
No,
it was like 24 hours a day for him.
Right.
He had the largest desk I've ever seen in my life. It looked like a football field. I think it was 100 yards long.
Very true. And he was very nondescript in how
he
lived.
And he had files on every inch of it. You know?
Very nondescript in where he lived, too. It wasn't opulent. I think he just had an apartment.
A little apartment, yeah.
Yeah, I need to live like that.
He lived at Country Club in Six for a long, long time.
Yes, very much.
In a very, very modest apartment.
Very
and he could have bought that apartment complex 15 times or 100 times.
Right.
I mean, you know, what are you living here for?
Right.
I could buy and sell this place for every one of them.
Right.
But you know, that's just the way he chose to live.
What a great life. I mean, if you have a great life.
He bought a place right there at Sixth and the new development at the corner.
Right across from the football field.
Right across from the football field.
Yeah, it used to be Soho.
He bought an upstairs apartment, somebody told me.
Yeah, yeah. There was the restaurant at the bottom.
Yeah.
And upstairs was his place.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, right. He wanted to be as close as he could to Bear
Down. Right. That's a great spot. That's a prime spot.
Yeah.
Prime spot. Well, what a fantastic life he had.
Yeah, it really was amazing. And, of course, I knew Frank, his younger brother, who was just a great disc jockey talent. He was a professional comedian for a long time. His album, My Plumber Doesn't Make House Calls, is still a bestseller, I think. Jay Taylor was his partner, and, you know, they did all the talk shows at the time, Carson and all of them. And I think they did a cruise ship tour of South Africa. They told me it was a really tough audience. I don't remember what it was.
Yes.
But they were the funniest people on earth. And, of course, Frank Little, his brother, brokered this radio station sale just recently and has probably brokered every sale of a Tucson station in this market or any market in Southern Arizona. It just made a fortune doing that because he's just smart, really smart.
I don't think Tucson.
And is, for that matter.
I don't think Tucson understands how much that family played a part in a lot of things that have gone on over the last 50 years.
I would agree. That's a great point.
You know, because they've had their hands in a lot without wanting to be noticed or
exactly
just behind the scenes.
Yeah, you know, he gave us money for our bicycle program every year, and he never made a big deal out of it. He said, don't even mention it, whatever. And I just thought that was amazing. He said, no, here's the money for the bikes, and I want to help you because we believe this is a great program you've got. But that was just the way it was.
Yeah.
You know, we're going to miss him, you know?
Yeah.
And there's not that many people that are accorded that kind of access to that University of Arizona program that George had.
Right.
And there was never any doubt he had any influence of recruiting. He was never brought into any scandal that a booster, so-called booster, would have.
Right. It's funny, in doing these stories with him on the book, he was not a big basketball fan, per se. Like, you know, who'd win, who cared, love all these big names. He just loved going to the events, supporting his team and the guys.
Really?
It was, not like you, because you're a fan. You know what's going on with Kansas or whatever. You see, you know, there was a pick and roll, blah, blah, blah.
Sure.
He didn't care about stuff like that. He enjoyed being part of it.
And he always had seats immediately behind the bench, right?
If the camera was there, you'd see him.
George.
Yeah, you could see Lute, and you could see George behind the scenes, or Sean behind the scenes.
Yeah, and he attended games until just recently when he was ill. All the way through.
Right, no, I'd see him. He'd show up in a wheelchair. He was in a wheelchair for a while at the end. But, you know, he was out and about still. In that, I wrote about it yesterday, that red shirt. That red short sleeve shirt. He was out, and then he was hello in his voice, like kind of like your voice, kind of hello. How are you? How are you doing?
Well, you know, the one thing about that is that we're probably never going to see much like him again.
No,
you know,
no.
I mean, somebody that would devote so much of their life to that one particular program,
sure.
University of Arizona basketball.
I don't, if he's number one in that list, I don't even know who the
number two would be. I don't think there is a two.
You're right. There's not a two.
And there were people that went to away games, but they didn't go to a mall.
And I've seen most. I've seen most of them. I haven't been on the road much in the last 10 years since the paper closed. But you had some of those that were part of that group that would travel a lot. But I don't know who they are now.
I would hope the University of Arizona would have a favorite fan memorial for him, something. I mean, they need to honor him for not only his generosity and his partnership, but just for being George Khalil.
Oh, yeah. I think they will.
There's got to be a way to be able to establish something in his name, a scholarship or something that allows us to say thank you.
Yes.
Because we all owe him a debt of gratitude.
He helped with the Lute Olson statue. I'm pretty sure that was part of it.
Did he really?
Oh, yeah. Because, you know, he wanted stuff like that to be done.
Yeah.
Yeah. Behind the scenes as well.
Well, do we have any memorial service?
I do not know yet. I think it's too early.
Too early for that. Right. Well, I appreciate you coming by and talking about
this. Yeah, sure.
We're going to be talking about it. What's on your show today?
I have a president of the Mexican Basketball League. Some players from America has played down there. And we're going to have him. We're going to have Pete Delgado, a former KVOA TV sports broadcaster. And then I have Jude DeCava. He's a TV broadcaster in Phoenix. No. Just to get the scene of the Cardinals start. The Diamondbacks are in the heavy playing time right now. We'll see what happens.
By the way, the Suns going to be able to turn this thing around.
They're horrible.
They don't know what they're doing, do they?
No, but do you know Robert Sarver?
I knew his father very well, Jack Sarver.
It's just a disaster.
I had an incredible relationship. I worked for him for a while. Jack Sarver, who owned the Plaza at the time. These are his sons.
Yes.
And they wound up owning the Suns.
A lot of money, but this team is just this franchise is not very good.
Do they not know what they're doing?
Doesn't seem like they do.
Colangelo can't tell them?
He's long gone. They said, Jerry, thanks for the money. We're gone. We're leaving.
All right. Listen, thanks so much for stopping by.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Thank you, Jack.
Steve Rivera's Eye on the Ball Sports Show coming up next. This broadcast of the John C. Scott Political Forum brought to you by Perfection Auto Works at 1046 North Beverly, 323-8650. Get a hold of Mike Emery if you want your car repaired right. Mike Emery's an honest, wonderful guy. They can repair your car at a price you'll be shocked at. Perfection Auto Works, 1040 North Beverly, proud sponsor of the John C. Scott Political Forum. Have a great weekend, everybody. Back on Monday for more of our broadcast finals. This is KPOI, the voice, trusted local news and talk. This has been the John C. Scott Political Forum, now in our 31st year of continuous political talk. Thanks for listening, everyone. Have a great evening.